From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the controversies surrounding the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. The fund is supposed to give the families of victims a cash amount related to the victims' projected earnings had they lived. This is resulting in feuds, lawsuits, and moral questions about the relative value of a victim's life. We'll talk with Lisa Belkin, who wrote about the fund for the New York Times Magazine. We'll also talk about her Times column, Life's Work, about the intersection of work and personal life. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why the nearly archaic language of courtship is showing up on newspaper business pages. And rock historian Ed Ward reviews When the Sun Goes Down, the secret history of rock and roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A North Korean ship carrying Scud missiles is proceeding to Yemen 2 days after the ship was stopped on the high seas. The U.S. government had kept the ship under its control while its cargo was investigated. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
U.S. intelligence agencies had been tracking the ship since it left its North Korean port more than 3 weeks ago. Administration officials say the Yemeni government initially said it had not ordered the missiles. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said U.S. and Spanish authorities decided to stop the ship on the high seas and search its cargo because they were not sure who the shipment was for or what was actually on board.
If we had concerns about something that we didn't know where exactly where it was going or exactly what was on there, the last thing you want to do is to say to somebody, by the way, would you mind telling us?
The Yemeni government was forced to swallow its previous denials about the missile shipment. The U.S. government, realizing the missiles had been legally bought and paid for, was forced to allow the shipment to continue. For both parties, a somewhat embarrassing episode. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
A joint House-Senate committee reported today on its probe of intelligence lapses leading up to the September 11th attacks. The committee, which spent 10 months on its investigation, recommended that the nation's intelligence agencies be gathered under a cabinet-level Secretary of Intelligence. The report blamed the U.S. intelligence community for poor communication, causing important clues to be ignored and preventing information from being shared. It called for structural changes in the CIA, the FBI, and other intelligence agencies that would help coordinate their work. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott broke his silence today after setting off a controversy with racial overtones nearly a week ago. The Mississippi Republican had suggested the nation would be better off if Senator Strom Thurmond had been elected president when he ran on a segregationist platform in 1948. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
On a day when morning newspapers carried accounts of Lott having made remarks 22 years ago nearly identical to those he made last week, Lott spoke on Fox News TV with conservative radio host Sean Hannity. Lott said the problems he'd asserted could have been avoided had Thurmond become president were not related to race.
We've had problems over the years with defense budgets, you know, law enforcement. I think we could have done a better job.
Lott said he may have left the impression in a written apology he issued Monday that it was only for those he defended.
Let me rephrase that. I apologize for the words, and I'm sorry that I used words that were insensitive and have conveyed, an impression that is not an accurate one.
Leading Democrats, meanwhile, called on President Bush to repudiate Lott's statements. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 15 points to close at 85.89. The NASDAQ gained 6 points. This is NPR News. Former Senator George Mitchell has withdrawn from the new commission set up to investigate the September 11th attacks. Mitchell, who has served as the U.S. mediator in Northern Ireland, said he didn't want to leave his law practice. Mitchell was to have been vice chairman of the commission under the leadership of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. He will be replaced by former Representative Lee Hamilton, an Indiana Democrat. President Bush has called the Prime Minister of Denmark to help Turkey join the European Union. EU leaders are holding a summit on enlargement later this week in the Danish capital. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Copenhagen.
President Bush made the phone call after a visit to Washington by Turkey's new leader. The Danish Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, is the acting head of the European Union. Rasmussen's office said he would share the contents of the phone conversation with the 14 other European Union leaders tomorrow night. They're meeting for an historic summit which should see 10 new members, mostly from Eastern Europe, join the EU. Turkey would like to join too. Its new government has taken steps to improve human rights, but the EU is hinting it may still have to wait until 2005. Washington is exerting pressure on the EU so Turkey will lend support in any war against its neighbor, Iraq. That pressure has caused resentment. Europe's External Affairs Commissioner has quipped that maybe Mexico should join the United States. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Copenhagen.
President Bush has set up an independent commission to consider the future of the U.S. Postal Service. Administration officials said the commission will deal with the agency's decline in mail volume and competition from private carriers and internet email. The 9-member commission has until the end of July to make its recommendation. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Less than 2 weeks after September 11th, Congress passed a bill authorizing financial compensation for the families of people who were killed in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But the results have included exactly what the bill was intended to avoid: anger, feuds, and lawsuits. And a lot of questions are being raised now that probably should have been addressed before the bill was written. Questions like, why is one victim's life worth more than another's? Why are these victims being compensated when victims of previous terrorist attacks have not been? And will this be the model if we're attacked again? My guest Lisa Belkin wrote about the Victim Compensation Fund for the New York Times Magazine this past Sunday. She also writes the Times column Life's Work about the intersection of work and life. Many of her columns are collected in her book Life's Work. The bill that created the Victim Compensation Fund was rushed through Congress in 3 days. I asked Lisa Belkin to explain the larger bill the fund was attached to and how it was passed.
It was never intended to help the victims, or at least not as it was originally formed. On September 12th, the airline industry came to Congress and the White House and said, we're losing our insurance, and if we lose our insurance, we can't fly. And one of the reasons they were losing their insurance was threat of lawsuits, threat of liability for all the damage that had been done the day before. So Congress and the White House created something called the Airline Safety and Stabilization Act. And it provided money, it provided loan guarantees, it also provided a cap on liability. It said people can sue, but they can only recover to the limit of the insurance that was carried by each plane. And each plane carried $1.5 billion in insurance, which is a lot of money in a normal airplane crash, but this clearly was not a normal airplane crash. I mean, the estimates now are about $40 to $50 billion in damage that was done on the ground. And the Congress said, you know, you're not liable for any more than $1.5 billion per plane. And at the last minute, people stood up, mostly the American Trial Lawyers Association, and said, you can't take away the right to sue, which in effect is what you're doing. You can't take away the right to sue without giving something back to the victims' families. And so in Section 6 of an 8-section act that was designed to save the airlines is the Victim Compensation Fund. And it says, okay, if you waive your right to sue, we will compensate you in the way that the court would have done. And that's where this ball started rolling. And it's ended up in places that no one expected, people didn't anticipate. And I would say pretty much no one is happy with the way it's working.
So what is the basic formula that the Victim Compensation Fund created for compensating the families of people who were killed on September 11th?
There were two ways they could have gone. They could have said, here is a set amount of money. Everyone gets the same thing. And there was some talk of that. But at one point, Tom Daschle said, well, do you want to decide the amount? Do you want to put a price on human life right now? I don't. And that sort of shut down that conversation. And the Democrats mostly said, if we're taking away the tort system, we have to pay like the tort system. We have to pay like the courts do. And the way the courts do is they figure out actual monetary damages. They figure out what someone was worth, what the lifetime, you know, projected lifetime earnings of that individual would have been. There are charts, lots of charts that do this. and then pay that. And they deduct what are called offsets. They deduct things like life insurance, money already paid in different forms, pension. And so that was the direction the legislation took. So that's what the fund did. What it opened itself up to, of course, was questions of, well, why is her husband worth more than my husband? How can you value different people differently? And it's getting ugly.
Tell us more details about how this process decides how much a victim is worth financially.
Inevitably, it decides that different people are worth different amounts financially. It looks at a janitor or a dishwasher and says they were making this amount of money at this age. They had, you know, X amount of working years left to them, and odds are they would have gotten wage increases of, you know, Y percent, and therefore the total amount of money that they would have earned in a lifetime, the loss, the actual economic loss to their family is, you know, you spit out the final number. It then looks at a bond broker and does the same thing. Well, the bond broker lifetime earnings is going to be in the millions and millions of dollars. And the firefighters were in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, particularly after you subtract things like the insurance that came with the job. And it all got so complex, actually, that Kenneth Feinberg, who is the special master, the man in charge of doing all of this, which is another thing the legislation did in its wisdom, it gave all the power to one person. And Senator Chuck Hagel said to me, well, we punt it. You know, we figured he would figure out the details. And so all of the details are in the hands of this one man with a broad outline set by Congress that says you have to do it this way, but we're not going to give you any hints as to what to do, you know, within this framework. And Feinberg has yet to decide what numbers he's going to use for the people who made over $231,000. Because you had bond traders who were making $1 million a year. The amount of money that by these charts they should be receiving, their family should be receiving, is, you know, $10 million. And then there's the question of, do we want to be paying? We being the American people who are paying for this, is taxpayer money, you know, is that the best way to be spending the money, to pay one person $10 million and to pay someone else $250,000, $500,000? It just feels very unfair. And yet again, the families on the upper ends are saying, wait a second, why are these charts okay? Why is it okay to follow the numbers and, frankly, follow the legislation when it comes to people making less money? But it's suddenly not fair to follow those same rules, the rule that exists in law, just because you don't like that the number's too big. And so that's sort of the arguing and jockeying that's going on right now with the families and with Ken Feinberg.
What are some of the specific arguments that families who are getting paid comparatively less are taking to Feinberg?
That my loved one would have gone to college and made more money and gotten a better job. That he was the sole supporter of three different families, one back home, one here, and his elderly mother. And so that money is just more important to more people. The specifics range everywhere from solid economic arguments to videotapes that he's receiving of people at birthday parties to show how full of life they were and what a huge loss it is. It's heart-wrenching. I mean, we're applying numbers to something that is raw and emotional, and that fit never works. And yet it's surprising to everybody that the fit isn't working, that people are frustrated, that they're feeling devalued. And actually, what I find most interesting is that there's the beginning, I think, of a backlash against the families. People are beginning to accuse them of being greedy. The whole conversation is about money. The families all say, you know, it's not about the money, it's not about the money. It is about the money. It has to be about the money because money is all we have. And so from the outside looking in, it always looks, not just in this tragedy, but obviously this tragedy is bigger, but it always looks as if the survivors are obsessed somehow, have gotten greedy, have gotten things out of proportion. And I've come to the conclusion that there has to be something about money that the rest of us can't understand unless we've been through it. It's come to stand for something much more metaphorical than just what the money can buy. It's the fight to protect the last thing you have left of the person you love. And they'll be damned if one person is judged more valuable somehow than the other one. And so it's deeply hurtful to many families. And on the other hand, it is just money, and it has to be divided in a way that includes, you know, equations in black and white and dollars and cents.
My guest is Lisa Belkin. She wrote this week's New York Times Magazine cover story on the Victim Compensation Fund. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lisa Belkin, and she's the author of an article about the Victim Compensation Fund, which was created after September 11th to compensate the families of victims of September 11th. She also writes the Life's Work column for the New York Times. It's a column about the intersection of life and work. The Victims Compensation Fund is unprecedented. What are some of the many examples of families of victims who were never compensated by the government?
Well, if you go all the way back, I mean, they looked for precedent. There's the Holocaust, and, you know, Germany paid reparation, but that was the government that did it. There are some funds set up to help, you know, uranium miners or people who have suffered from certain vaccines. Other than that, there is nothing like this in the history of the United States. And being the first, people who think that they're comparable are starting to stand up and say, well, wait a second, why didn't anyone come up with this when Oklahoma City happened, or the USS Cole, or the embassies in East Africa? And they are just as hurt as the ones who were being offered less money or not enough money. I mean, it's the same feeling of, why is a bond trader in New York more valuable, worth more money than my daughter who was in the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City? And there's no answer. So now we have the situation of people from past events saying, what about me? I'm hurting too. And I think the more important question is, what do we tell the next group? Our government has more or less guaranteed us that, you know, inevitably something else will happen. And what do we tell those victims when they turn around and say, and the person I love is worth what? And so I would argue, and the reason I wrote the article, is we need to sort of fill in the philosophical foundation that was never placed under this legislation. We need to say, why are we paying these people?
The Congress never said that all victims of terrorism are entitled to compensation. What they said was the victims of September 11th are entitled because there was going to be a cap on what the airlines could pay out to families of victims. So is there anything you could read into this specific bill that talks about intentions for the future?
No. It specifically, very specifically, says this is the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. But the message is one that just, you know, it leaves a bad taste. The message is, well, if you are killed in an event that involves an industry that the American government really wants to save, well, then you're in luck. And if you're involved in, you know, if you're killed in an event that involves an industry we don't care so much about, well, then you're on your own. And it doesn't sit right. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't feel right, I don't think, to people. Now, maybe that is the message. Maybe that's where we'll end up. But that conversation never took place. The why never took place. The are we doing this as a metaphor? Is money a metaphor here? An attempt to thank you for your loss? Or is it a practical solution to a problem People, so many people died, so many of them without enough insurance. And so is there sort of a national obligation to help? No one ever asked any of those questions. And they're being asked now, a year later. And unless we answer them, unless we can say to the next victims, well, 9/11 was different because, or you're right, 9/11 was not different, and therefore, yes, you are included, the questions will be asked again and again and again.
Meanwhile, some families are actually choosing to sue the airlines, even though the Victim Compensation Fund was supposed to prevent that from happening. Why are some families suing the airlines, and what are they suing for?
Different reasons for different people who are suing. Some are suing because they are, in effect, not included in the Victim Compensation Fund. If you had enough insurance, in other words, if the presumptive award based on the charts was $2 million and your husband carried $1.5 million in insurance, then that's subtracted, his pension is subtracted, and in effect, you are left getting very little money from the fund, so you might as well sue. I mean, in stark mathematical terms, you might as well sue, because if you win, potentially there's a greater reward there. I'm not hearing that that's most of the people. Most of the people suing can't afford to. They really should be taking this money if you looked at it in stark monetary terms. But they want answers. They want to show the airlines that they should have been more vigilant. They want, you know, papers opened and people subpoenaed and investigations to occur that they feel that only a lawsuit will do.
There are also some suits planned against the Port Authority in Manhattan and in New Jersey, claiming that they were responsible for safety failures and inadequate evacuation procedures. What are those suits about?
There are, most of the suits are against the airlines. Some of them are in ancillary ways against the screeners at the airports, the companies that were responsible for screening at airports. Although, interestingly, box cutters were legal on September 11th. There are suits against the Port Authority for improper communication, for not telling people to get out of the second tower when that would have saved their lives, of not having signs saying that the roof was closed so people went up when they should have been coming down. If you look closely enough into anything, I think we've learned you can find somebody who, if they had done something differently, things might have turned out differently for someone. And this is what our legal system does. So, yes, there are lawsuits against everyone. Interestingly, one of the places I looked at when I wrote the article was Israel. In Israel, nobody sues. There are no lawsuits against bus companies. And since September 11th of 2001, 500 people have died in Israel. And proportionally, if you multiply out based on their population in ratio to our population, that's like a September 11th there every other month.
Wow.
No one has sued the bus companies in Israel. And I spoke to one of the biggest lawyers in Israel who actually has brought a number of lawsuits against the Palestinian Authority. And I said, well, why not the bus companies for improper security? And she said, well, you know, the bus companies didn't want to hurt any Israelis.
Well, what does the Israel government do, if anything, to compensate the families of victims of terrorism?
Well, that's the big difference, and that's likely why people sue less in Israel, is because they're taken care of. There is a plan in place, has been for almost 30 years now, that says that any victim of what's called a hostile incident in Israel is entitled to lifelong care, not millions of dollars, and not a lump sum, interestingly. And the head of this fund in Israel was thoroughly confused as to why we were handing people this much money all at once, and discussed sort of what the ramifications of that, the potential downside of that could be. But it's a monthly pension, and it's exactly the same as is received by the family of a soldier killed in battle in Israel. It's a monthly pension, the equivalent of 1 month's salary, the average Israeli salary. And it also includes many things like education for children for the rest of their lives through college, psychological counseling through college. And it takes care of people. I mean, it's a completely different philosophy, not necessarily one that will translate to the United States, but it is a practical look at money. Okay, what do you need in order to live? Not how much can we pay you to show that the person you loved was worth something.
Now, is Kenneth Feinberg, who's the head of the Victim Compensation Fund and who is charged with figuring out how much each family should get, is he happy with the way this is working?
He won't come outright and say Congress made a mistake. He comes very close to saying that if he were to do it again, if Congress were to do it again, it really should have been a set payment. You know, $1 million. We're very sorry. We wish you the best and goodbye. And it would have prevented everything that happened since. So he's frustrated. The families are frustrated with him, too. I mean, this is not a man who makes quick decisions, even though he promises them. He doesn't know what to do about the highest earners, so he's left them sitting for a year without any idea what they're going to get. I mean, there's huge frustration on both sides. And he has his questions, and he'll say only a certain amount of it publicly. But I think just the way he answers makes it clear that he thinks it should have been done differently.
Has anybody actually gotten paid out from the Victim Compensation Fund yet?
Yes, there have been a handful of payouts. I don't know what the number is now. I know that when I last finished researching it, it was about, you know, a couple of dozen. Interestingly, families aren't applying in the numbers that you would have expected. About 25% of the families eligible to apply had applied as of about Thanksgiving. And many of them are holding back. I mean, some of them are holding back because they want to hold open their option to sue. Some of them are holding back because they want to see more people go through the pipeline to get more of an idea of what's going to happen to them. It's a fairly complicated process. I sat down to fill out the forms as though I were filling them out having lost my spouse. And I didn't know where much of that information was. And so it's also you feel like you're jumping in, I think, to a process that you're not quite clear where it's going to turn out, and there's something very final to it. I'm going to take my money, and then somehow it's supposed to be over. So I think emotionally there's a hesitancy on the part of families who are less desperate for the money and aren't quite sure that they are ready to confront this process emotionally.
Lisa Belkin's article on the Victim Compensation Fund was the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk about her New York Times column on balancing work and personal life in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sugar Association, educating consumers about sugar. Sugar, the natural sweetener, 15 calories per teaspoon. On the web at sugar.org. And Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the intersection of life and work. We talk with Lisa Belkin about her New York Times column, Life's Work. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the nearly archaic language of courtship has ended up on the business pages. And Ed Ward reviews When the Sun Goes Down, the secret history of rock and roll. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lisa Belkin. She wrote this week's New York Times Magazine cover story on the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund. She also writes the Times column, Life's Work. It's about the intersection of work and personal life and the daily collisions that happen at that intersection. Many of her columns are collected in her book, Life's Work. The dedication in your book, Life's Work, is dedicated to the thousands who on September 11th gave their lives at work. I thought that was such a really interesting way of putting it. Could you just talk a little bit about that dedication?
That's all they did. They got up in the morning and they went to work. And as someone who writes about work and what sort of work takes away from your life, it was haunting to me. I was finishing the book on September 11th. It was due on October 9th. And so the last few weeks of putting it together were completely enmeshed with all the emotion and the anguish of that tragedy. There couldn't be any other dedication. It was the only one that made sense.
How did you start writing this column?
I had a really bad day one day. I write for the New York Times Magazine. I had a magazine piece closing. I was at the same moment that the magazine piece was closing, I had to take my then 4-year-old, I think he was, to the pediatrician's office for a checkup. And it was one of those checkups that included shots. And I'd promised I'd be there. And I also needed to close this magazine piece. So what I did was, I tried to be super mommy. And I had them fax the galleys to me at home. And I ripped them out of the machine. And I raced Alex to the pediatrician's office. And he was lying with his head on my lap in the waiting room, kind of whimpering because he didn't want shots. And I had the galleys literally over his head. And I was sort of editing and making changes because I needed to get them back by a certain time. I mean, short of human cloning, this was the only solution I could come up with. And I looked across the room and this woman was just glaring at me like I was mommy dearest. And and I just sort of looked over to her and, gave this kind of, neither of us were having a good day. She was in the pediatrician's office waiting room, too. And it was kind of this almost this shrug of, I'm doing the best I can. And for me, it was either an epiphany or a nervous breakdown. But the idea that doing the best you can has to count. And it doesn't always work out so that you feel like you're handling it, but trying matters. And it was about, I would say, a couple of days after that I get a call from the business section of the Times saying, we're writing a column, we're thinking of starting this column about life and work, and since you're such a great example of balance, we were wondering if you would take it on. And, the irony was too good to passed up. I was looking for answers. I mean, I'm a parent of two sons, and I was looking for answers. I figured that I would call lots of smart people, and they would all tell me how to do it, and then I would write this how-to column. I haven't gotten any answers in 3 years. I mean, I've gotten a lot of questions. I've involved in a remarkable conversation with thousands of readers, and I've learned there are no answers, that doing the best you can matters. And so I'm not a great example of balance. I'm a great example of how no one's a great example of balance. They're just sort of all running in place and trying really hard.
Now, you actually work at home.
I do.
What are some of the things you've gained? What are some of the things you feel you've given up by working at home?
I changed the location of the juggling act, but I'm still dropping balls all over the place. They're just different balls. I'm still juggling. My first day at home, Alex was not born yet. I was actually pregnant with Alex, and Evan was about 3. And I came downstairs in my sweats, and which was the entire point, was to work in my sweats. And I had breakfast with him, and my babysitter came, and I kissed him sweetly and said, bye-bye, honey, mommy's going to work now. I went upstairs to this office over the garage that I'd created so I could be super mommy. And I closed the door, and Evan began to shriek, and he screamed outside my door for the better part of 3 days. And looking back, of course it makes sense. I mean, he had far more sartorial sense than I ever would have suspected. I mean, mommy dresses one way when she's mommy and one way when she's leaving. And here, mommy was mommy and mommy was home, but mommy wasn't his. And what I finally did is I got up and I, you know, put on hose and heels and a suit and I kissed him and said, bye bye, sweetie, I'm going to work now. And I went to the local diner and I had, you know, a cup of coffee and a muffin. And then I snuck back into my own house and I finally got some work done. And I did that for a decent amount of time. They're older now. They get it. I feel like I've gained a lot being at home and that I can be at the things I need to be at. I think that I will never be executive editor of the New York Times. I will never go, you know, overseas on some plum foreign assignment. I've given things up. They're my choice. I can live with them happily. But to pretend that we can all do whatever we want is a fiction. What we need to do is sort of define what it is we want and then try and structure a life around that as best we can.
My guest is Lisa Belkin. She writes the New York Times column, Life's Work. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Lisa Belkin is my guest, and her article on the Victim Compensation Fund was published in this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Lisa Belkin also writes a column for the New York Times, which is called Life's Work, and it's about the intersection of life and work. She has a book as well called Life's Work, which collects some of her columns. It's subtitled Confessions of an Unbalanced Mom. Lisa, are you married?
I am. My husband is a professor of medicine and has ridiculous hours.
Okay, just the point I was trying to get to. Now,
yes.
He can't do all that work at home. So since you're the one who's working at home, do you get stuck with more than what you think is your share of the errands and of the household work that needs to be done?
Yes, although define my share. I mean, I purposely ratcheted back, and then I have more time, and so then I fill that time doing sort of things for the family, and then I get to rant and rave that how come I do everything around here. The most interesting column in terms of response that I wrote was something called The Grapes of Marital Wrath, and it was about a professor, a law professor at Georgetown, who went to work every day and wrote sort of academic articles for law journals about gender equality or inequality in the workplace. And she started to notice that she would spend the first couple of hours of her day or a good chunk of her day sort of calling home, checking in with her babysitter, arranging play dates, calling the preschool, getting on the waiting list, you know, make it anything but work. And her husband would go to work and he would work. And she started thinking, well, if things can't be equal at home, then how can they ever be equal at work? In other words, if women are coming and doing the sort of lagging half of a second job while they're at their first job, or maybe it's the other way around, then how can you possibly have gender equality in the workplace? So she set out to explore this as a sort of academic exercise and came to the conclusion that a lot of the inequality at home is women's fault. I waited 6 months to write this column because I figured I had to sort of accumulate some goodwill among readers before I started saying this out loud. But what she said made me look at myself. She said that basically there are things that women in particular hoard as, if I don't do this, then I'm not a good parent, or as, I'm the only one who can do this properly. He can never do it, and therefore I'm not going to let him because he'll screw it up. And the title, The Grapes of Marital Wrath, came from a woman who stood up at a meeting I was at and talking about exactly this subject and said, you know, I don't let my husband go to the supermarket anymore because he always gets the wrong thing, and or else it's the wrong brand, or he forgets something, and so I might as well just go myself. And she said, and last time he brought back 5 pounds of brown grapes. And the column was about letting go of some things. The column was about saying some of what you do is because it has to be done. And some of the too much that you do is because you're feeling guilty that you're not doing enough and you're not doing everything your mother did or your grandmother did. And so some of this stuff can go.
I think for some spouses, whether it's like the husband or the wife who's taking on the extra responsibilities, it's kind of like training an intern at work. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it's worth it. Sometimes it's easier to just do it yourself than to go through all the emotional and physical work of getting the spouse to do that.
Yeah, I think that that is very much the way a lot of people feel. I've said it out loud. I've told my husband and I've told audiences. Yeah, sometimes it's just easier to do it myself. And then, of course, I get to complain that I'm the one who does everything. With us, it's buying shoes. I mean, Bruce knows how to buy shoes. Bruce wears shoes. But for some reason, I'm the one who buys the kids' shoes. And if I had to examine it deep down, it's because somehow I get emotional goodies from that. It's sort of this primal I have shod my children feeling, but I can't give that one up. And then I can blame him because how come he doesn't know his children's shoe size?
I'm sure something that can be the source of reassurance for you is that every time something goes terribly wrong in your life, in that intersection between life and work, it's at least potentially the subject of another column.
Yeah, at least I'll get a column out of this. Yes, I have said that once or twice. You also have to be careful. I mean, I have a deal with my children that I will not embarrass them in public.
But by whose terms? Who gets to decide what's embarrassing?
If I write about them, I tell them about it in advance. I don't, and maybe it makes the column a little less honest. But if I have to do a trade-off, it's an obvious trade-off.
How old are they now?
They're 8 and 11, uh-huh. And the 11-year-old's beginning to get embarrassed by me.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm sure it'll only get worse.
It will absolutely only get worse. And it was important advice I got from Anna Quinlan when I first started, who basically said that no column is worth a relationship. And I've kept that firmly in mind. And so Bruce does get veto power and has not vetoed anything yet.
That's your husband?
That's my husband. And because no column is worth a relationship. But then again, it also isn't always about me. I mean, I try very hard to make this about other people sometimes. And so there are ways of writing about subjects without completely embarrassing your family.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Lisa Belkin's New York Times column is called Life's Work, which is also the name of her book. The language of seduction used to include words like suitor and wooing. These words are rarely used today to describe lovers, but they show up frequently on the business pages. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to the way we talk about corporate mergers and what it says about our changing ideas of love and money.
There are a few things as dogged as a business writer who gets a meaty metaphor between his teeth. Here's how Business Week described the recent announcement of a merger between two cruise ship lines. The path to the altar is strewn with crushed hearts, but no broken engagement between companies has proved quite so stunning as the one that befell Royal Caribbean International. It stood ready to seal a merger with P&O Princess Cruises before a congregation of investors, but then rival suitor Carnival Cruise Line swung in. Now P&O Princess has kissed off Royal Caribbean and is betrothed to Carnival. That's typical of the way mergers and acquisitions are described nowadays, with a quiver full of words borrowed from the old language of courtship. In fact, the business pages are about the only places where these words are still being used. The other day, I looked up the first 50 hits for the word suitor from a Nexus database of major newspapers. 48 of them involved business deals of one sort or another. One other came from the plot summary of a movie about King Arthur. And the last was from a palace gossip story about the rivals for Princess Di's affections after her separation, which is only marginally closer to real life than Camelot was. Suitor isn't a word that pops up a lot on Sex and the City. Or take the verb woo. You read about companies wooing investors, politicians wooing voters, and teams wooing fans. But lovers don't talk much about wooing anymore, except in fits of coyness or nostalgia. You don't suppose you could woo me a little first? That language has been receding for a long time. The word courting was already on the way out by the late 19th century, when people began to feel that the rituals of courtship were impediments to the candor that true affinity required. Anthony Trollope only put the word courting into the mouths of his lower middle class and lower class characters, and within a few years it had become the stuff of rustic comedy. By the beginning of the 20th century, people were taking up the new slang word dating with its modern egalitarian syntax. Only men could be suitors or go courting, but women could date men as easily as the other way around. But the very things that make the language of courtship sound anachronistic for talking about our love lives make it a handy language for describing corporate couplings. As that root court reminds us, the vocabulary has always been drawn from the language of politics and influence, ever since it was first cooked up by the 12th century nobles and poets who laid down the codes of courtly love. And the words of courtship have always been charged with double meanings of power and sex. The verb court means both to pay amorous attention and to try to gain favor with someone. For that matter, the word favor has the same ambiguity between the meaning good graces and its sexual sense, what people used to describe delicately as the last favor, as in she granted him the last favor. And until recent times, a suitor could be either a lover or a petitioner. Those ambiguities are summed up in the underlying plea of all courtly attentions, be mine. That's what makes the language a natural fit for the corporate world, the last place left where you can realize your dynastic ambitions by getting somebody to change their name to yours. The super mergers that have built today's corporate giants recall the intricate maneuverings of an age when Catherine of Braganza could arrive in England for her marriage to Charles II with a trousseau bulging with 2 million crowns and big chunks of India and Morocco. Even more to the point, the language of courtship has always involved a certain charade of power as the suitor abases himself in order to gain the upper hand. Samuel Richardson observed that the gallantries always came down to the same message. I am now, dear madam, your humble servant. Pray be so good as to let me be your master. That's a fair paraphrase of the blandishments that companies like Tyco and WorldCom dangled before the companies they were acquiring. And in the end, the stockholders wound up in pretty much the same compromised position as Richardson's heroine Clarissa did. In fact, if there's travesty here, it isn't because corporate CEOs are any more devious or rapacious than the courtiers they replaced, but because they're a lot more banal. The ardent avowals of courtly love may have been disingenuous, but that's something poetry will be eternally grateful for. Whereas the romance of the modern boardroom is pretty prosaic stuff in every sense of the term. Imagine what a Sidney or Marlowe would have had to come up with if they'd been working as corporate publicists spinning their company's takeover bids. Come merge with us, and we shall seize 10,000 win-win synergies.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward reviews When the Sun Goes Down, the secret history of rock and roll. This is Fresh Air. The surge in American roots music has caught the record industry off guard, and its response has been to look back into the past for material that might interest the people who bought the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack and the reissue of the Harry Smith anthology of American folk music. RCA has entered the fray with 4 CDs from its back catalog, issued under the title When the Sun Goes Down. Rock historian Ed Ward has this review.
Won't quiet you, then ride down. And baby, let your mind roll on. Hey, walk quiet. They don't know why. But daddy, you can't stay too long. Not everybody's coming by the field way walking. See, you want to lose your mind. Hey, walk quiet. Head right down. And daddy, let your mind roll on.
Releasing CD compilations of old 78s won't exactly assure you of a commercial blockbuster, so it was with great interest that I opened the mail a few weeks back and found the four volumes of RCA's When the Sun Goes Down series, subtitled The Secret History of Rock and Roll. Covering the time span between the late 20s and the mid-50s, and compiled by the noted archivist Colin Escott, it's a collection of mostly African-American music from deepest country blues to early R&B. The good news is that it's on RCA, a label that made high-quality records of a great spectrum of American folk artists during this period. The bad news is that it's on RCA, a label infamous for recording tons of second-rate blues in particular during the late 30s and 40s. But there was a lot here I wasn't familiar with, as well as some welcome old friends.
Wake up, Mama, turn your lamp down low. Wake up, Mama, turn your lamp down low. Have you got the nerve to drive Papa Mactel from your door? My mother, daddy left me reckless. My daddy left me wild. Mother, daddy left me reckless. Daddy left me wild. No, I'm not good-looking, but I'm some sweet woman's angel child.
Blind Willie McTell's Statesboro Blues certainly qualifies for the Rock and Roll History title, since it's been recorded by dozens of folk rock, and rock bands, including Taj Mahal and the Allman Brothers. And as far as I can tell, this is its first appearance on a legitimate CD. Then there are songs whose original versions I'd never heard. For instance, I knew the Youngbloods' version of When I Woke Up This Morning, She Was Gone, which they called Grizzly Bear, but I'd never heard Jim Jackson do it.
When I woke up this morning, she's gone. She made me mad. I felt so sad. But I would not tell you reason why.
It was Volume 3, That's Chicago's South Side, that I was dreading, though. RCA set up its Race Records subsidiary, Bluebird, in Chicago, and recorded a load of musicians there, many of whom weren't very good. There were exceptions, of course.
Hello, little schoolgirl. Good morning, little schoolgirl. Can I go home? Can I go home? Now you can tell your mother and your father that Sonny Boy's a little schoolboy.
The original Sonny Boy Williamson was a Bluebird artist and a big enough star that Rice Miller, a harmonica player from Mississippi, took his name after he was murdered and used it all over Chicago. He even recorded his own version of Good Morning Little Schoolgirl. Both versions are classics, but the original is not always the greatest.
I got gonna sail to some foreign distant land. I got gonna sail to some foreign distant land. And I'm gonna be some other woman's man. Sail on, sail on, little girl, sail on.
Muddy Waters, like a lot of the generation of Chicago bluesmen who came after the Bluebird crowd, recorded some of their material, including Bumblebee Slim's Sail On. There's no doubt in my mind which version is better. And another interesting thing about this collection is that they give the performers real names. It took me a minute to realize that the Amos Easton listed on the cover is really Bumblebee Slim. How many people will recognize Minnie McCoy as Memphis Minnie? Perhaps unwittingly, what this series does is point out some serious holes in RCA's CD reissue program. For instance, once upon a time, there was a whole LP of the mysterious Lil Green.
You had plenty of money in 1922, but you let other women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. You sitting down wondering.
And although the label never recorded much group harmony, there was a double LP by a little known but very influential 30s group called The Cats and a Fiddle that shows that blander groups like the Mills Brothers and the Inkspots weren't the only show in town.
Babe, we got to have little talk. I ought to pack up my things and walk. I know a dollar goes from hand to hand. Before I let you go from man to man, I'd rather drink muddy water, sleep in a hollow log.
All in all, though, this is an admirable collection. The secret history of rock and roll? No, not exactly. But it's a well-chosen trawl through a bewilderingly huge catalog, readably annotated and admirably remastered. Will it have the same impact as the reissued Harry Smith anthology or Revenant's masterful reissue of the Charlie Patton records? Probably not. But if it stays in print long enough to interest some young people in this music, that can't help but be a good thing.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed the 4-CD set, When the Sun Goes Down. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Well, now that's all right, no mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, no mama. Any way you do, but that's all right. That's all right. That's all right now, mama. Any way you do. Well, my mama, she done told me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing nearly 3 million members with customer-focused financial strategies and service, online at thrivent.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a portrait of a writer. We talk with photographer Marion Ettlinger, who specializes in taking pictures of writers for magazines and book jackets. And John Searles will tell us about his misadventures and makeovers getting his picture taken for his book, Boy Still Missing. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.